Well, the thing though is here's my strange logic about it. He seems so evil that you wouldn't think he's evil, but that's why he actually is evil. That's the chain of logic I'm going after there.
But that doesn't make sense.
Sure. He just said evil like four times, and that was it.
Welcome. We are the Vassals of Kingsgrave, and this is the next episode of our great linear reread of A Song of Ice and Fire by George R. R. Martin. As usual, this podcast may contain spoilers for the entire book series, but we'll be free of Game of Thrones show spoilers. For this installment of the reread, I'm joined by Zach.
Hey guys, this is Alias in the forums.
Casey.
Hi, this is Casey, Blue-Eyed Queen on the forums.
And also Matt.
Farley on the forums.
And Alex.
Hi, Wendy on the forums.
And we might be joined later by Adam. So welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining me. We will start off with Davos 6. So it's just one chapter after the last we read on the previous reread. So we left the Purple Wedding on January 1st, 300 and Sansa 5. And this is actually 3 days later on January 4th, and this is Davos 6. So I think Alex will read a summary.
A completely original summary. So Davos watches from above as Melisandre leads the evening devotions at the Nightfires. Stannis, Selys, Shireen, Axel Florent, and Davos's son Devon Seaworth are among the devotees, although Stannis is not as fervent as the others are. He mostly just stands there gritting his teeth. Sir Andrew, who is a king's man who is helping Davos, walks up to him and tells him it is time, and they set to work along with some other conspirators. They go to Maester Pylos's room, where Edric Storm is getting a lesson on sums. Pylos tells Edric to go with Davos, and Edric resists at first, but Davos cajoles him into coming, and as he's talking, he mostly tells him that he's acting against Stannis' orders, but Edric is cool with it. They join some other men at a postern gate, where the guards have been tied up, and one of Salador San's ship, Mad Prendos, is waiting to take Edric away. Everyone goes with him, except for Davos and Sir Roland. Davos makes the long, lonely walk to the stone drum and up to the chamber of the painted table and waits for Stannis. After a while, he hears Stannis and Melisandre approaching. Melisandre is telling Stannis that she saw Joffrey dead in the flames, but Stannis will not be convinced until the information is verified. Davos announces that Joffrey is indeed dead. Salador's ships still trading King's Landing, and one of them brought back the news. Melisandre says that Stannis must give him Edric now, and Stannis reluctantly agrees that there is no other way. Davos tells them what he did. Stannis gets angry and draws Lightbringer, but gives Davos a chance to explain, all the while pointing his sword at him. Davos says a king must protect his people, and pulls out a scrap of paper and starts reading. And that's where the chapter ends.
Yeah, so first thing I wanted to note about this is that, so as we were saying, it's the last Davos chapter of Storm, so next time we will see Davos is in Dance. And also, next time we will see Stannis is at the Battle of the Wall, so this is really the turning point in Stannis' arc. And you can kind of feel that at the end of the chapter, right? It's really mysterious piece of paper.
Yeah, for me, I really think of this moment as Stannis's lowest point that we've seen in all the books. You know, he wants to steal gold from these outlying islands. He wants to kill this boy, Edric Storm, and he has no real plan going forward. And it just has this weird like feeling like Melisandre has completely taken over the people of King's Landing, or of not King's Landing, of Dragonstone. You know, there's just this weird like ritual feeling to it, where everything seems off, but Davos comes forward and saves it all with that one scrap of paper and really gets him back on track.
Yeah, I agree with Zach. Like, I mean, they're just burning people alive, like the non-believers alive or whatever. And, you know, he sinks so low that he's about to like execute Davos. And then, like you said, he kind of turns him and brings him back to the good side.
Like Zach was saying, until then, Stannis doesn't really have a plan. Like, he's just waiting to see if Melisandre's prophecy comes true, or the thing with the three kings. And he doesn't really have anything planned apart from, well, we'll just see if all the kings die. And if so, then I guess I'll be the king and I'll burn this kid alive. And there's no real strategy to it. It's kind of like throwing stuff at the Red God and hoping it will work.
Yeah, I feel like Stannis was like, oh, now here's clear proof that the magic worked, so let's do more magic. And, you know, I always wonder, like, how much he really believes in this. Like, there seems like chapters where he's like, this is it, this is what we're doing. There's no other way about it. But then at the beginning of this chapter, it's noted that, like, Stannis looks, he's, like, clenching his jaw. He's really angry. And I wonder, like, how... like if he's going along with it because of just Mel, or if he actually believes in this religion.
I think he feels trapped. I don't think it's so much any kind of fervent belief, but he honestly feels like this is his only option at this point. You know, he feels like he has this duty to take over and to assert his rightful rule, but his only way is to go with this Red God until Davos gives him this other option.
I think what annoys him is fanaticism. Like, if the magic works, well, the magic works and he's fine with it. It's just the whole devotions and silly leading the responses and being like all fanatic. That's what annoys him, I think. He doesn't really believe. He doesn't really care about the faith.
I feel like for him, it's a necessary evil because he believes he's the rightful king. And that the realm is his by right, and he shouldn't have to do anything to become the ruler, but there are all these obstacles in the way, and he has to do something about all his rivals, and Melisandre is that kind of that tool to, and the whole religion is just a means to an end.
Yeah.
I don't think he really believes in the whole mythology, but he believes that it does have power and that power can be useful to him.
It is definitely one of those things, though, where when you start to rely on something that heavily, even if you at first don't believe that you need it or don't believe that it's important or you think it's just a tool, you can start to really come to depend on it and rely on it, and it can start to consume you.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like that's what kind of drives him to these really immoral and quite stupid choices, like deciding to kill Edric Storm. That's not a very smart move to do strategically, because it makes him seen as a kinslayer and someone who kills innocent children. That's not really great for his image, but... he's so consumed with, like, this is the only way to make things work for him that it becomes really problematic.
Yeah, when you think about it, a lot of this business of being a king is kind of like marketing, right? You know,
yeah,
you really have to
definitely
present the right kind of image and brand. And Davos gives him, you know, the great opportunity to really just, you know, spin up his image and get it in good shape. as opposed to going down the kinslaying route, which probably would have ended badly.
And do you think so?
Do you think it would work?
Well, I mean, doesn't seem like there is justice for kinslaying. And, like, the fact that we're kind of counting on that, just like there isn't really justice for, like, you know, guest right and stuff like that. I don't feel like we can depend on these things that we feel like we should get justice for, that traditionally and culturally in Westeros, that it, you know, it's kind of anathema to, you know, the gods should rain down justice on, like, people, the kinslayers and guest right breakers, but I don't think we'll see. I don't think we would have saw it if he did burn Edric Storm. I don't know what would have happened necessarily, but yeah, I don't think we're going to see any kind of justice like that.
Well, when I make the point about marketing, I think that the idea there, right, is not that, and I think we'll probably get into this more with the Bran chapter too, is that it's not necessarily that the gods will rain down justice for this misdeed. It's more so that it just destroys his credibility, you know, as a ruler. It would limit his ability to gain allies and to gain support, I think. And, you know, maybe not. Maybe people really don't care about this bastard of Robert. You know, it's okay if he kills him off. And hey, if he gets the dragon out of it or whatever he wants, then maybe it's worth it. Maybe that's enough, you know, of the you know, the opposite side where he just has such strength and power that he can assert his will. But I don't know. I think that wouldn't have worked out.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been completely demoralizing, right? If he burned Edric Storm and no dragon came up, everyone would have been like, well, fuck.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think it might have been the end of Davos' loyalty. Like,
oh, definitely.
Even in this chapter, Davos thinks about how he would like to just go back to his wife and mourn for his sons and... But he doesn't ever do that because he has too much love and loyalty for Stannis. But this, I think, would have ended that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Davos would have lived to leave in that scenario, because I think he would have laid down his life to keep Stannis from doing that.
Yeah.
But if he did, I don't see how Davos could stay with Stannis if he did kill Edric. I think Davos has made that very clear that this is the line he will not cross.
Yeah, but I mean, even at this point, he's like, you know, execute me as your man. I'll die like as loyal to you, you know, even though I'm telling you stuff you don't want to hear. Like, I think Davos, I don't know what, you know, I guess this whole chapter is kind of him being disloyal, but you know, looking out for Stannis' best interests at the same time. I'm not sure. I'm confused.
I think he's trying, he's really trying to, I mean, that's what he says at the end of the chapter, that a king protects his people, and Edric Storm is of his people, and I think it's very true that it, for Stannis, he already has a bad image as it is. Stuff like burning a 13-year-old boy alive would not go well.
I do wonder though, like, what Stannis's what Davos's limit might be for Stannis. Like, if that's the limit, then are we eventually going to see that, like, limit come up again, or are we? I don't know what the future holds for Stannis, but
awful Davos.
Yeah,
I mean, at this point. We have no idea if they will meet up again, because Davos has gone to Skagos, right? So it's kind of, ever since this moment when Davos convinces him to go save the wall, they're separated, right? Davos goes to the sisters and then to White Harbor and then Skagos. And I wonder if that's saying that Davos gave everything he could give to Stannis, and that now he's not going to bring anything to his arc. I don't know.
Yeah, well, what does Davos do in A Dance of Dragons besides, like, go to White Harbor and be imprisoned? Like, I honestly, like, can't remember besides, like, the, like, pepper crab stew at the sisters. Like, what is he trying to do? Drum up support?
I think the point for Davos is to actually raise the North.
Yeah, because what Stannis is doing, all that Stannis does after fighting the Wildlings is try to get the North on his side, to claim Winterfell, like kick the Boltons and Freys out mostly.
Yeah, and when Davos gets to White Harbor, that's what he tries to do, right? He tries to present himself to Manderly and give his pitch, I guess. And
yeah, it's all marketing.
Exactly.
It's all marketing.
It's like Shark Tank.
He's trying to sell the brand new king, Stannis. Look at what a good king he is. Marketing.
I got it. After establishing himself on the wall and trying unsuccessfully to acquire the support of Northern Lords through messages, Stannis sent Davos to White Harbor as an envoy to Manderly, whose wealth was vital to his war effort.
That makes so much sense.
Yes, that's it. And he left from the wall. Yes, he was with Stannis up until the wall. That's what I wasn't sure of.
Cool. Clear on Glad we got that straight.
Yeah, we have an excuse. It's chapters that we have not actually reread yet in this. So.
Plus, they're purposefully confusing because we're supposed to think for a while that Davos is dead, and we don't even know that Stannis is going to the wall at this point. I mean, it's not explicitly stated, and it's kind of a surprise when he shows up. So yeah,
it's kind of awesome when he shows up in that Jon chapter.
So awesome.
Like, what the fuck are those, trumpets? The Wildlings don't have trumpets?
It's not that far away, actually, in the published order, because it's
well,
like
yeah, because the
John
Wildlings
10.
Are almost at the wall.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, it's like in 10 chapters. Yeah, it's really close. I wanted to ask, did Stannis really, really believe that they would call for him now at King's Landing? Like, oh, Joffrey is dead. Everyone is dead. Maybe they will just give me a call and I go there. I mean,
it's like every job interview I've had.
I mean, there's no way the Lannister ever gonna call Stannis. That doesn't make sense.
No, I mean, maybe he's that dumb, but I don't think so. I mean, there's no possible way that would happen.
I was surprised Stannis was the one who wrote letters to the whole kingdom to discredit Cersei and Jaime, and like I don't see what he expects from the people that he trash talked.
And no one cared about these letters. Like nothing came of it. I mean,
didn't Baelish like turn it on his head that like Selyse had sex with Patchface to get Shireen? Yeah, I'm pretty sure Melisandre tells like after like Joffrey's dead, surely they'll call for me, and she's like, they won't. Another pretender will come up.
Well, I mean, and there's like, just Tommen.
Yeah, there's Tommen. So
Tommen is so perfect because they can actually rule instead of him. So
won't make any impulsive decisions.
Yeah,
we do get some insight on this chapter with like how Robert treated his children, though, because he does mention how Tommen's milder than Joffrey, but there was that whole story with the rats, which I feel like 2 out of 3 of these chapters are very rat filled. but they told the story about how Joffrey like killed a rat to like see its babies, and then Robert completely just like smacked him in the face.
I think it was a cat.
Oh, it was a cat?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and that was Joffrey.
I said Joffrey.
Oh, I thought you said Tommen.
No, Tommen never killed a cat. Oh my God.
Tommen loves
what kind of a monster are you?
I see where the confusion was though, Casey, because in the Bran chapter that we're gonna get to, they talk about how the rats are as big as cats. So
There we go. That was it.
Which is also kind of terrifying because they see a rat that's as big as a cat, and they're like, oh, no, it's only cat-sized.
It's like only as big as a cat. I'm sitting here like, wait, that's not how you should phrase that.
Oh. Off the topic of rats. I just wanted to note that we get some insight into the children's relationship with Robert Baratheon, and it's sad. It's really sad that that's like a stark memory of Joffrey after he died. Although I feel Stannis probably just doesn't have any love for him because he believes he's not his nephew. It's just awful.
Also, on the flip side, you have Edric Storm, who completely idolizes Robert. It's like, he's the best dad ever, even though I never saw him.
Yeah, he just idolizes him as, like, he was the king, the one true king, and that was his dad, even though he's a bastard son of him, which it is really sad. Although I do wonder if he'll ever come up again, because I was looking to see if, like, he comes up in Feast or Dance, and I think it just, like, says that he's somewhere in one of the books, but we don't see him again after this.
He went to the Free Cities, didn't he? Didn't he go to Braavos or something?
I think so. Maybe Lys.
Maybe we'll see him in an Arya chapter.
He'll be a faceless storm.
Yeah, she'll think it's Gendry or something.
Yeah, she'll be like, I have a friend who looks just like you.
But I mean, if every character that we don't really know where he is, but he is probably in the Free Cities, meets up with Arya, it's going to be kind of too easy. It's a big place. Maybe she doesn't have to meet everyone from Westeros over there.
I mean, she met Sam.
Yeah.
Anything's possible.
Okay. Do we have anything else to say on this chapter?
No, let's move on to the chapter with unpronounceable names.
No, I have another thing. Go ahead, Casey.
Okay, I just wanted to pull up a quote that made me feel a little uneasy in the chapter. It was by Stannis towards the end. He says, if I must sacrifice one child to the flames to save a million from the dark, sacrifice is never easy, Stavos. Or it is no true sacrifice. Tell him. And I was just like a little worried about Shireen when I read that. But, you know, I wonder how far Stannis would go if that was the price for something when he needed something dire. I don't know.
And Melisandre kind of doubles down. It's like if a man sacrifices one cow and it's his only cow or whatever, and then she brings up Azor Ahai sacrificing his wife. It's like, oh boy.
Right. It has more weight to it when it really feels like a loss, not just some random kid. Oh, brutal.
But Stannis was intending to kill Edric before anybody else, so.
Yeah. Plus, like, there's no guarantee that it'll do anything.
I mean, those three kings are dead, so it definitely worked.
Yeah, but even in this chapter, Davos tells him, like, he choked on a pie or he was poisoned by his uncle. Like, there is no divine intervention in this scenario.
I mean, even Stannis says something like, whoever killed him, whether it's the Red God or the Imp. And so even he is, I mean, he's not sure that it's the magic.
Yeah.
Too bad Tyrion didn't know that, because doesn't he say in his chapter, he's like, blame the doves or the pie, just leave me out of it. He's like,
blame the pie. Blame Stannis, leave me out of it.
It's his fault. Yeah, I think even given all that, though, even given sort of the other reasons why these kings might have died, Stannis can't forget that Renly died because of magic. You know, it was magic that killed him, and it was real, so he can never forget that.
Yeah, but it wasn't the same kind of magic.
Right, it's just kind of proof that there is power there.
Yeah.
There is something to be used. Whether or not it's actually going to work out for him is another question, but yeah, there is power.
Yeah, and I think that Melisandre's demonstrated that by the two shadow babies and, like, the, you know, beating Crescent's poison and, you know.
Sure.
But, like, she's definitely demonstrated it, but I don't think, like, the burning of the leeches and, like, you know, she didn't actually send, like, shadow babies after him, like, you know.
No. I think that was a pure charlatan move, but I think, Stannis has that one piece of evidence that there is magic. It's not all fake. So we can't, you know, entirely discount it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like one of them lived to like a ripe old age and then finally died. It'd be like, you see, got him.
Oh yeah, you can always come up with a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had one other thing in this chapter that is probably just a coincidence, but At one point, Davos is looking at the stars, and he's talking about the Ice Dragon constellation, which we've heard mentioned before. And he says most of the stars are blocked out by clouds, but the Ice Dragon's eyes are visible, and they are two blue stars. So, is the Ice Dragon part of the others?
There is no question. Ice Dragon.
What? Of course there is. They're just waiting for the last battle to bring him out and destroy everything. Bring down the wall. That's how it's going to happen.
Yeah. No, I think they're just like regular constellations like we have on Earth. Like, we just call them something stupid, you know? It's like, oh, that's an Ice Dragon, you know? Oh, that's the handle of the Big Dipper, like, which is the tail of the Big Bear, which is like something else in some other culture, you know?
Big Dipper is going to come down and smash the wall.
Yeah. It's going to, like, ladle out soup onto the wall and melt it.
Melt it, yep.
Melting the wall with soup.
We figured it out.
I think it's more a question of imagery. Like, I don't know if it really means anything, but it's always the same images that come up in these books, and we have the blue that just reminds us of the others and the threat on Westeros. I mean, it's present everywhere in the books. We have these kinds of,
Well, yeah, and then you get the same thing on the other side with, like, you know, Blood Raven's red eyes, Werewood red eyes, Ghost's red eyes, Melisandre's red eyes, you know, just like, okay, got it. Ice and fire, got it.
So, do you think Blood Raven and Melisandre are on the same side?
I mean, insofar as both of them have red eyes and want to fight the others, I guess, yeah.
Melisandre is Shira Sea Star, confirmed.
Oh, boy. And they're going to reunite, and he's going to be like, yay, I always wanted you, and, you know. But now I'm a tree.
They find love despite that.
I'm a tree for him.
Okay, should we move on to Dany?
Yes.
Sounds good to me.
If we have to.
Wow. Okay.
Wow, what an enthusiastic.
Okay, so after Davos 6, we skip forward one day to the 5th of January. And this is the first Dany chapter from A Dance with Dragons, which is very exciting. So if we are taking Feast into account, this is actually 67 chapters later in the published order, or 11 years if you were waiting for the books. Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
But it's just
one day, 56 chapters, 2 books,
exactly.
11 years.
Exactly. But in the linear time, the last time we saw Dany was a month ago. So, well, we can all catch up with Zach's recap.
All right, ready for some bad pronunciation. Here we go.
Dude, don't worry about it.
Just call them all Harzu.
They're stupid.
Whatever it takes.
I want the worst pronunciation of every name.
That's what I love, like, Green Guts or whatever his name is, Quentin's friend. He's like, Hazu. It's like, they're all Hazu.
All right. So Dany sits on her ebon bench, her throne as ruler of Meereen, as a dead man is brought before her. Barristan explains that they found a harpy drawn in blood by the corpse. When asked why the Unsullied was not with his partner, Grey Worm explains that the soldier, Stalwart Shield, had not been on duty. He had gone to a brothel to seek companionship when the Sons of the Harpy set upon him. Dany acknowledges that even now she is still fighting a war. Barristan remarks that the Unsullied are ill-equipped to uncover spies and dissidents. But all of Dany's other forces, the sellswords led by Brown Ben Plum and Darya Naharis, and the Dothraki are all dispatched on other duties. Dany excuses herself from the conversation, dons her floppy ears, and prepares to hold court. She meets with her advisors, Resnak Moresnak and Skahaz Mokandak, the Shape Pate. The Shape Pate argues for an aggressive response to the Harpies, and Resnak a more measured approach. Dany wonders which one of them may join her list of traitors. Dany meets with her petitioners at court, first an envoy from Cleon the Butcher, King of Astapor, who promises his loyalty to the Dragon Queen with a pair of slippers. Next, a wealthy merchant named Hisdarza Lorak comes forth to argue that the fighting pits of Meereen may be reopened. Dany says no for a sixth time. Dany deals with nobles and freedmen in turn, dealing out rulings to each of them, as Dany promises to compensate a group of herders for the sheep that her dragon burned. One last man hangs back. He brings forth a sack and spills broken and blackened bones before her. Dany realizes that these are not the bones of a sheep, but a child. So yeah, back with Dany here in A Dance with Dragons, holding court in Meereen. Very cool.
Everybody, I like how Barristan is still around.
Yeah, he's cool. I'm a fan.
It was interesting how both this chapter and Davos's chapter started off with like purple skyline or imagery or something like that, if I remember correctly. I thought it was funny because they're definitely not in order and they're not even in the same book. Sorry, lame. The comparison.
Never.
So, does anyone else like kind of notice that? I mean, as far as the books as a whole, like the Davos chapter we just read, like how it got its point across, and how this chapter just went on and on and on, and it's like, I think like the editors just like don't even bother with George anymore. Like half of this stuff, I feel like, is just like, I just don't get it. I don't understand it.
I mean, I know how you feel because I fell asleep twice while reading this last night. But I might have been a little tired. But no, like this chapter went on for a really long time, and the writing does seem a lot different than Storm of Swords. And I mean, like there is 11 years between these two books, though I wonder how much of that chapter he wrote while potentially writing Feast for Crows.
As much as I, you know, agree with you guys, and I'll never claim to be the biggest fan of the last couple of books for many reasons, I do think at least in this chapter, it's kind of deliberate to an extent that it feels so belabored, you know, given that the point here is that Dany is holding like this endless day of court, that you're really supposed to feel is like more and more people come in and they give their kind of petty petitions to the court, and she has to, you know, deal out these rulings to them. I think that that's kind of the point in this one. For me, the frustration comes when we have that point kind of, I feel, succinctly made in this chapter, and then it kind of goes on and on in the chapters to follow as Dany kind of wrestles with this whole point about whether or not this is what she's supposed to be doing and how to, you know, balance these sides of her.
Yeah, I mean, the chapter does do a really good job of just how alien this place is for her, and she should probably leave, but she doesn't.
I just, with Matt saying about how Dany just seems out of place here, I felt like this is where I start to, like, this is my lull of I don't really like Dany right now, where she did this really awesome thing in Storm of Swords where she, like, you know, ended slavery. But then she kind of goes back into this, like, weird, I'm also a noble person, and she wears the tokar, and she tries to be queenly in this world where, like, she tried to end, like, the hierarchy of people. And, I mean, I would like to use the word colonialism with this. I feel like it's just, she's, like, trying to make these people into, like, her civilized ideal of Westeros, where I don't think that she realizes that it can't be that way.
Yeah, exactly. That was my point, too. From this chapter alone, you can see that it's never going to work. I mean, you cannot build anything after what happened, and it's just so different. And you see that. I mean, there's no way this big mix of people from slaves to masters is going to make any kind of a society, of a working, functioning society.
Yeah, especially because she doesn't want to be too extreme on either side. So she's trying to fit in with the nobles by wearing the togar and kind of embracing the traditions, but she's also really strict on slavery and the fighting pits, and she's trying her hardest to make the former slaves better, but she can't really do anything for their living conditions because they also depend on their former masters. And it's this whole vicious circle where she can't really do anything to stop the, well, basically the social order of slavery from returning, because the whole society is still pretty much in place, and she just outlawed the concept of slavery, but without changing the rest of the framework, really.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think to inject a little Breaking Bad into this, there are a lot of half measures that Dani is employing here, and she never really fully commits to anyone's strategy, and therefore she is just treading water the whole time. She's not able to really achieve anything.
Not to get too like economical here, but I feel like we're talking about marketing economics in Westeros. But no, like, she ended slavery, but then like she didn't like produce any jobs for, like, you know, to make it so like the people who were slaves have like high paying jobs, and that the people who were owning them before like don't get angry that they're not being as compensated as much. It's a little bit like, you know, and with the lack of food and all the other things going on, everybody's just angry. And they kind of like don't know how to change, and they fall back into their kind of roles without saying that the slaves are being slaves.
Yeah.
Yeah. You figure like you could probably like hire some as like dragon walkers, you know, that would, you know, bring them to a special place so they could go to the bathroom or something, you know, not eat sheep all the fucking time. Like, I get pissed off if I find dog shit in my yard. What happens with 23 people? Like, those are like, you got to figure, like, this is, like, every day, like, when she holds court, 23 people come in with, like, these are my dead sheep, like, compensate me. And then this one guy brings in his daughter or whatever. And it's like, what the I don't know. It annoys me.
It's funny because it clearly annoys Dani, too, right? You know, she feels like she's already done with this. She's already not happy from chapter one. The thing that ultimately moderates all that for me, though, is that as much as, you know, we're frustrated and she's frustrated with the whole situation, the thing that, you know, kind of always gets in the way with the whole idea, like, why doesn't she just go to Westeros, is that she can't really, you know, like, ultimately, if we're talking logistically, and they go through this at the end of the Storm of Swords, when she ultimately makes this choice, is that, you know, she doesn't have any options, really. She can take the Boneway and get her forces annihilated, or ships could magically show up, or she could, you know, make a bad deal with some kind of person in the Free Cities, but she really doesn't have a lot of options at this point. She's just kind of waiting it out and seeing if some opportunity appears.
Didn't Zaro?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Doesn't Zaro come and offer ships again, and she still turns them down?
Yeah, because it would kind of limit her power if she was beholden to him.
No, he wants her out of there.
Yeah, later in Dance. That's right, but I think she kind of senses the treachery in that offer too. And I don't remember, but I think it's something like every merchant in Karth is gonna just give like one ship, but it wouldn't be enough, I think, to take everyone she wants to take with her. So.
Like, at that point, there's like a level of sunk cost fallacy with her. Like, she's invested so much time and energy into this that she hopes that it'll eventually work out. And it does not.
Yeah.
And so many people hate her that she can't really leave without it having repercussions on her either.
Yeah, it's like Afghanistan or Vietnam.
Yep.
I was going to make a comparison with maybe a bad one, but like, she tries to just change the society in such an immense way and really like without leaving them any choice. And it's just so brutal. It's very brutal, to change the society this way. And it just made me think, about the revolution in France,
which one?
Well, the 1789 one.
The French
one. The capital R French revolution.
Exactly. Because, I mean, it's totally different, but it at least showed that, I mean, there was a need for a change in the society and the way it worked. But when trying to just change it brutally, it just doesn't really work. And in the end, the process was much longer than just the few years. The few years that we call the revolution are not exactly what really changed the society, and it needed so many decades after that to evolve into something really new, which was not another kind of a tyranny. So what yeah. I mean is you just can never change something as anchored as this society was so quickly.
Also, the French Revolution was French people having a revolution against other French people. This is yeah. Dani showing up in a place where she's a complete outsider. She knows nothing about the place, and she tries to bring revolution there just by imposing her own Westerosi standards on this completely different place. And of course, she's helping one side more than the other. Like, she's trying to free the slaves.
Yeah, but they don't even, I mean, it's not even that good for them.
Yeah, it is exactly.
In principle, because they end up living on the streets and just doing the same things they were doing, so.
Right, it's more yeah. of a power shift with the power structure, you know, being dissolved, but she's still in. Like, I don't understand why it takes her so long in this book regarding the fucking fighting pits. Like, just let them fight. It's amusement. Like, everyone's pissed off to begin with. Like, what does it, like, she only cares about brutality when it's against her own enemies. Like, she, like, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't, it, like, she thinks that they need to be peaceful and, like, not own slaves, but she gives no alternatives besides she's ruling now.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and also another thing that strikes me in this chapter is that she is very dismissive of Yunkai's army and, well, the possible consequences that could have for her of leaving Yunkai alone. And she's also very optimistic about Hisdar, saying that he has connections in all the neighboring cities and he's very wealthy and he's basically going to make all her problems go away. But as we know from later, that's not really the case. Like, Hisdar, yeah, he's great. He has all these connections. But first of all, we don't really know what side he's playing. And also, one man can't really do much for this whole shitstorm that she initiated.
I like that the Unsullied go to brothels.
Yeah. Yeah, let's not forget about Stalwart Shield.
Yeah.
So sad.
Also,
so sad.
Why sad. Can she not just hire a detective to solve this problem? No, but like,
private eye, Westeros private
eye. She thinks Sherlock Holmes when you meet him, right?
But she thinks she can just solve this problem by discussing it for 5 minutes with her advisors, like, in the stairway before her court session. She's just like, just throw money at it, it'll go away. But she needs an actual police force to, well, first of all, kind of keep the streets safe, because it doesn't look great at the moment. And
she has
also
a standing army, not an occupation force.
Yeah, and, like, solve these crimes.
Yeah, I mean, she needs policies and education, and she needs the government. She doesn't need.
She needs fairies.
She does.
So, can you remind me, do we know if the shave pay is bad? Because we do find out that Hisdar is working with the harpies, right, in this book?
It's unclear to me.
It's unclear.
I think he's bad. I think he is actually the person who poisoned the locusts and all that stuff.
Are you talking about Hisdar or Skaz?
Skaz. But okay. But it's not 100% clear. We don't know.
Yeah.
Because I figure the shave pay is just kind of out there looking to, like, increase his family's value while decreasing it. That's why he keeps on, like, saying like, oh, take hostages and execute them or whatever. It's a great family. It's like, but so how would poisoning locusts work out for him?
Look, he's very ugly, so he must be evil.
Well, the thing, though, is here's my strange logic about it. He seems so evil that you wouldn't think he's evil, but that's why he actually is evil. That's the chain of logic I'm going after there.
But that doesn't make sense. He just said evil like four times, and that was it.
Well, so it's the levels, the layers of deception. I think he is responsible. I think he wants to create a power base for himself. You know, he's setting Barristan off in this one direction to ultimately create more chaos. You know, he's chaos is a laddering all this stuff. Like, he wants to take control.
He's Littlefinger.
For sure.
Confirmed.
I think Resnak, the one that we all think is actually the traitor because he seems so innocuous, is not.
Which one is Resnak?
The perfumed Seneschal.
The perfumed one.
The Seneschal, yeah.
And we don't like him because of Quaithe? Because she say, yeah, beware the perfumed Seneschal?
Yeah, but the perfumed Seneschal is also the name of the boat that Tyrion comes on.
It could also be Varys, because he fills that description as well.
Right, isn't it Stinky Advisor or something like that?
Yeah. Which is basically the same thing.
Okay, other serious thoughts about Dany?
The dragons are little shitheads, aren't they, though? They eat the goats, they bit Eerie, they burn one guy's tow car or whatever, and like, she's like, you know,
giant monsters. What do you expect? They're giant monstrous beasts. Like, what?
Yeah, but get your children together. It's like the screaming baby on the bus. Shut the fucking thing up. Like, come on, man. Like, we all have to live together, and your dragons are fucking messing everything up.
Well, that's actually a point I wanted to make earlier, that yes, she doesn't have a choice. She needs to stay in Meereen because she cannot really logistically go to Westeros. But she also knows that her main asset is going to be the dragons. Right. I mean,
you have to spend time letting that kind of grow in power and accumulate. It's just a time bomb.
Yeah, she needs time to educate them and learn what she can do with them and what she can make them do. So do that. Just don't put them in a pit and wait for them to, I don't know, disappear.
Or kill Quentin.
She's basically like North Korea right now. Just like, she has these weapons and she's kind of testing them out, feeling what they can do. Like.
But no, I feel like, is it possible to, like, you know, quote unquote educate or train like the dragons? It seems like
they made a movie called How to Teach a Dragon.
Yeah, she should go watch that movie. No, but like even at the end of the book when she flies off on Drogon, like it seems like she has a hard time getting him to do that even. So I don't know, like I wonder how like trainable.
But she doesn't even spend any time trying. Like she just lets them roam and eat sheep and children, apparently, and she is just spending all day in her uncomfortable bench listening to people's complaints. She doesn't have time
for her dragons.
Dragon
what to do.
Well, I think she can, but it also isn't like an innate
It would take
ability.
A lot of her time, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, Adam's here.
Yeah, Adam's here.
What's up?
So yeah, the dragons. I agree that she cannot really, I mean, she has no idea what to do, but bury your head in the sand and do nothing is not a solution.
Yeah, I agree.
I almost wonder if she's kind of having like a mom moment where she's like in denial that they're getting older and more dangerous. so, you know, she does.
Yeah, it's like when your teacher tells you that your kid is the problem kid and you're like, no. obviously those sheep were getting in their way.
But obviously, like, you don't like just lock them up. Like, I feel like she does ends up doing like the wrong thing. Like, that's just gonna make them angry when they see her again.
She's a first time parent, you know. The next hatch of dragon she has, like, you know, it'll go much easier.
Yeah. On plus, she didn't have the time to train one and then have another and do it like gradually. She had three at the same time, so she's
kind
of stuck with this.
Brings up this brings up another point, just kind of in the dragon lore of Westeros, is that you can only have one dragon. Like, that's how it's always kind of been. Like, these are her dragons, and they kind of listen to her. But, like, if she can ride Drogon, I don't think she could try to ride the other ones. That's, at least that's how it's historically been. So someone else would have to train them.
Quentin tried.
Yeah.
Keyword tried.
He failed.
Quentin lives!
Let's go back to the better book.
I did want to note, though, that in this chapter we get that pyramid thing is 800 feet, which is taller than the wall. So that's weird.
George is great with measurements, the best at measurements.
I blame the empirical system.
Giscard. No, if it was
meters, he would have been like 1,000 meters. That's a nice round number.
The end of this chapter is always really striking to me. I don't know about you guys, but I like the reaction, Danny's reactions to the child's bones are just, it's just very striking, very sad, and very, like, shocking.
Yeah, and it's something that we constantly go back to, right? I think if there's one thing that, you know, as much as we might be annoyed by kind of Danny's arc in this book, you definitely see a theme being kind of set out from this chapter that carries throughout in a lot of ways, and a big part of that is definitely the situation with the burned child.
Yeah. And that also explains why she just almost gives up on the dragons, and because she just doesn't want to risk anything like this happening again, so...
Yeah, this is the big problem with her arc, I guess, is that everyone's like, the dragons are your biggest asset, focus on them. And she's like, well, I need to learn how to rule. It's like, well, I mean, you know, maybe controlling your nuclear weapons would be a good start.
Yep. Should we go back to the better book, as you were saying?
Please.
All right. So after Danny, we go back, well, again, counting feasts, which I don't know if that really makes sense since it kind of happens simultaneously, but it's 70 chapters in the published orders, and we go back to A Storm of Sword for the events that happen a day later on January 6th in Bran 4, and that's Casey.
All right, so Bran and the crew pull up to another castle, which Bran knows is the Nightfort. And just to clear up with you guys first, because I read the chapter and then I read the Tower of the Hand, and the Tower of the Hand made it sound like they were in two castles during this chapter, but the way I read it, I thought that he was in the Nightfort the whole time. So does anybody know the answer to that?
They talk about the whole Alysanne's Tower that they were at before, but I don't think they were actually there in this chapter.
Yeah, they're just like chilling in the kitchen.
Yeah, and they mention other castles, but they don't go there.
Yeah. Tower of the Hand's wrong.
All right. Oh, no.
Citation needed, Tower of the Hand.
All right. So Bran knows it's the Night's Court, and he thinks it's the end of the world. He thinks of his recent dreams of Robb and Grey Wind, and they're dead. He's in fear of the Night's Court. Bran thinks of old Nan stories, including the Night's King, the Rat Cook, the 79 Sentinels, the rape and murder of Danny Flint, and other stories. He reminds himself that he's the Prince of Winterfell and that he has to be as brave as Robb was. Once inside, Bran sees there's no way to the other side of the wall that he knows of. He tells Jorgen that they should have stayed with Jon, but Jorgen reminds him that they would have been a bad idea and that Summer almost got killed by saving Jon's life. Mira wanted to climb the wall and have a look around, so she went up the icy stairs and climbed up them to go see what's up. And while she looked out of the wall, Bran, Summer, and Jojen went wandering around the castle to see what they might find, and they didn't really find much. Mira said that when she got down that she saw the haunted forest and a lake, but no way to get up and over the wall for everybody because it's too slick to climb down. There's no stairs. They still had no way across the wall except for what they know of Jojen's dreams. In the gloom, Bran thinks of the story of the Night's King, and as the story goes, the 13th man to lead the Night's Watch, a fearless warrior who chased a woman he saw from atop the wall, with skin as white as the moon and eyes like blue stars. fearing nothing, he chased and loved her, though her skin was cold as ice. And when he gave his seed to her, he gave his soul as well. When he came back to the wall, he proclaimed himself king and her as queen. And they used, quote, strange sorceries and bound his sworn brothers to him. After 13 years of rule, the Stark of Winterfell and Jormund of the Wildlings had joined to free the Watch from their spell. When they found the king had been sacrificing to the others, all records of the Night's King were destroyed and the name forbidden. Bran always ended saying the king was a Stark and the brother of the man who brought him down. Perhaps Brandon was the name. They slept in the kitchen, and Bran woke to noises inside the well. After some confusion and Bran warging into a frightened Hodor, Sam comes out, called out to stop. Sam and Gilly, scared, told them that they were told by Cold Hands that people would be in the castle. Reeds ask how they got through the wall, and Sam tells them of a gate that only a man of the Night's Watch can open. They described Cold Hands, a man who wears all black and is as cold as a white, but his eyes aren't blue. He cannot pass the gate as the wall has other magics that keep things beyond the wall. Sam leads Bran, the Reeds, and Hodor down to the gate, which is a weirwood. Sam recites part of his vows, and they pass through the wall. And that's the end of the chapter.
So, again, like, this is great, like, historic world building, like, all the stories about the Nightfort. And it's just so, the tone and just the feel of it is so much different from the chapter we just had of Dany.
Yeah, I feel like there's, like, a direct contrast with these two, with Dany being, like, definitively fire and maybe even Davos having more fire, like, imagery, and this being completely, like, you know, ice. Especially with the story of the Night's King, which I included that because I think it's a really important story to talk about, and it has a lot of, you know, potential theories in it and whatnot. And it's kind of cool to see how, in, you know, as the story goes, that wildlings and Starks work together as one time.
So we know Dany Flint was a woman that dressed up as a Night's Watch member, and they, like, raped and killed her. Do we know King Sherrett's curse or Simeon Star Eyes? I thought, like, he was Star Eyes because he had pieces of glass in his eyes instead, but they said where he saw the hellhounds. And then
He might have had magic sight, I guess, is the implication.
I don't think we hear about the hellhounds again.
Yeah, there's a couple of those where, like, they just come out of nowhere. I'm like, I want to know more about that.
Well, I think that's what's cool about it, though, right, is that you don't need to explore those stories in depth to get that weight of history and to get that sense of these stories to, you know, kind of picture and imagine what they might have been like. That's what's cool about it, I think, is that we can take, like, one line and extrapolate this whole interesting tale out of it. And, yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting. Like, I actually went back and tried to, like, find a lot of, like, what these stories were about that weren't, like, necessarily, like, all included in the chapter, because I mean I know some of them probably were mentioned earlier, but I kind of forget about a lot of them. But the Dany Flint one really struck me, although the only place I found information on it was YouTube, so, you know, I take it with, like, a grain of salt as being completely accurate, but in the time I was given, that's what I
looked for. Are you criticizing YouTube?
Oh, it's only on YouTube.
Well, don't they have songs about Dany Flint? Why do I think, like, you've heard that, like, in song form?
There was a song on YouTube that I listened to about it, but I wasn't sure if it was from the book or not, because I couldn't find, like, anything on the wiki, but I also didn't look that long, so.
Wow.
I don't know.
Tower of the Hand. Come on.
But no, it's really interesting. I mean, like, when I Googled Dany Flint, there was, like, a Reddit thread about them being Cold Hands, and I was like, okay.
Because of course there is.
Yeah.
Okay. Tower of the Hand says, a member of House Flint. Dany was raped and murdered at the Night Fort.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, that's about what we got out of this chapter.
Yeah.
But such an interesting story if, like, you know, what I read was true. Like, she went through all this crap and fled to the Night's Watch to pretend to be a guy and was successful until the awfulness of the rape and murder happened to her when she was outed. Yeah, just some lovely stories Bran listened to as a kid.
The Night's Watch is not great a lot of times.
Yeah.
I mean, even was that back when the Night's Watch was less like criminals and like murderers and rapists, and it was more like just volunteers back then, or it doesn't really say, does it?
I'm not sure what the time frame, like what when it was, but obviously, like, I don't think it really matters what time they were. The Night's Watch was just awful to her. Right. So
yeah,
I think that's interesting though, right? Because we mythologized the past of the Night's Watch like it was this great, wonderful thing, but it really never really was that way. Maybe it didn't have people you know, people that were considered criminals, but that doesn't mean they're not terrible people, you know?
Because even back in the day when it's like it was you know, the volunteer army, the best of the best, you know, watching the Wall. Like, you look at some of the stories from back then, and like, oh, they still have people that like tried to crown themselves king and do shit.
So reading this chapter, am I crazy to think that the Night's King is just a red herring? Like, I read this story and it doesn't seem that important to me. Like, it doesn't seem like there's any significance to the story beyond it just being that interesting story. And, you know, it's obviously like there's these seeds that you think could turn into something, and you think it might be an allegory for certain characters. But I don't know. I don't see this amounting to much.
I think it just parallels Stannis and Melisandre.
Right, that's the common theory, right?
That's just the only reason it's in here.
I was going to think that it's just like another instance of like other human interaction, similar to like Craster and like his kind of alliance with the others, and, you know, just that it can happen.
Well, as I read it, I kind of wonder, like, why so many people, like, theorize about who the Night's King is, or, like, potentially could be, or was, or that when there was, like, a definitive Night's Queen, that was, like, the definitive other. And I just wonder, like, why we don't focus on their, like, instead of it being a king, is there a queen out there? But I don't know, maybe that's too genderizing, but, you know, I wonder, I find that story very interesting as to, like, you know, the Night's King was definitively like a human being at one point, but the Night's Queen, we don't really have like a story about her other than that she was a mysterious woman, but beyond the Wall.
Did she survive though?
Hmm.
I don't know.
Was she destroyed? Because if she wasn't destroyed back then and she's an other, she could still be around.
That's for sure. Yeah.
Hmm.
I don't think she would be Melisandre, though, just to kind of consider that avenue, because we do have at least one POV of Melisandre, so it's probably
I was just saying the story parallels.
I agree.
Especially the part with the with the shadow babies, because I think the story says the Night's King, when he gave her his seed, he also gave her his soul or something like that, and that's very Stannis. Also, I feel like Sam leaves out a lot of crucial information when he's talking to Bran and the Reeds, because he mentions the Whites at one point, but he doesn't really go into detail. And then he's like, cold hands, but he's okay. He's not like the other things that are out there. But he doesn't go into detail saying what other things are out there. He's just like sending Bran off into this
zombie giant spiders.
Yeah. And Bran doesn't question anything either. He's just like, okay, we're going.
Yeah, he's like, do you want to lose Summer? Yeah? Didn't think so.
No, it is a little weird because he's like, he's so like brief, and he just like accepts that like these people that he's meeting up with in the Night's Ward are very like just normal people, nothing to be worried about, nothing's gonna harm him. It just seems like he shows up and he's like, oh, I was expecting people here.
Or but he I also think goes question, on for like, 5 minutes going like, oh my god, you stabbed me.
He's like sobbing too, apparently.
Yeah.
Oh, Sam.
So, do we ever get the visual of what Bran dreamt? Because they kind of just kind of refer to, like, he dreamt that, Rob and Grey Wind were blank, blank, blank. Like, he couldn't think about it. Like, did he see, like, the Red Wedding? Or did he see, like, you know, Grey Wind's head sewn onto Rob? What do you think that dream was? Because he begs the old gods not to send that dream to him again.
I do wonder about that too, because it doesn't mention Catelyn at all. So I wonder what he.
Oh, interesting.
I wonder what he saw exactly. If he just saw them dying, or like if it was symbolic, or if it was like the actual scene. I don't know. I thought it was interesting he didn't mention Catelyn. So that kind of like, I guess, it kind of foreshadows that something might be still kind of going on with her.
Yeah, she's not dead.
He said it was Summer's dream, so maybe it's just Summer seeing Grey Wind, and so Bran assumes that Rob is also dead, or he feels it because of the connection with the wolves.
Yeah. At this point, most of Bran's magic is through his warging into Summer, right? So I don't think he can just have a big vision or dream about the Red Wedding, but it probably comes from Summer's connection with Grey Wind and the other wolves.
And... Well, him and Rickon's had the same dream when their father was killed.
That's true.
Yeah. And was it Bran who dreamed about the sea coming to Winterfell? Or was it?
No, that was Jojen.
Jojen. Oh, okay. Yeah.
You do get the one dream, or it's not really a dream even, but it's the point where Bran is comatose and he kind of like zooms over to Catelyn's ship and all that stuff, and he sees all these things, the people at the Dairy Castle and all that stuff. So that's kind of a weird prophecy thing that's not connected to the Summer exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But yeah, I also wondered about this dream because it's barely mentioned at the beginning of the chapter, and then he doesn't really think about it. I mean, he does think about the fact that he doesn't want to have the same dream again, but I don't think we ever have the actual depiction of what the dream was.
Yeah, I want to know.
Well, I'm not sure I want to know, actually. Oh, yeah. It's very, very
we already kind of know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we already know enough.
Yeah, clearly it works effectively enough being something unknown.
Yeah.
Around the same time we find out about this dream without Rob, we also kind of find out about how Summer saves John, I guess. And it seemed like, I was like, this kind of seemed like out of the blue to me, like reading this along as like a linear reread. But then I remembered that the John chapter from, I think it was 51 because I was on it. Or maybe, no, I think it was earlier than that. You know, John has like that happen, and then like all this time goes past in the linear order, and then we like finally see like how Bran kind of helped him out there a little bit. I do wonder what would have happened though if Bran decided to like catch up with John instead. I don't think that would have. Obviously that's not Bran's purpose right now, is to like go to the Night's Watch, but it would have been interesting.
Well, he kind of wants to. It's like Jojen who says no, we have to go to the Nightforge.
Jojen.
Yeah, it's one of those annoying near misses where two characters you want to see interact just barely miss each other. Like, ah, so close.
So much of that happens in this book too. It's just like, Arya with Catelyn and Rob, for instance.
Yeah, but Summer does help Jon, and then Sam helps Bran, and then Arya helps Sam later on.
Yeah, we do.
It all comes full circle.
But we do have this interaction between Sam and Bran, and it's not as satisfying as Bran meeting up with Jon, but it does bring some, I don't know. I always enjoy seeing characters that are not in the same story arc meet and interact. I think it's satisfying in a way.
I agree.
Yeah, I enjoy this just as much as I enjoy like Arya meeting Sam.
So another interesting point. Am I the only one who's like, leave it to George to make even a pie made of princes sound pretty appetizing?
I
was like,
yeah, that sounds pretty good.
Prince and bacon pie. Yummy.
No,
with that flaky crust.
Yeah.
I was reading this and I still hadn't eaten breakfast yet, and I was like, oh my god, I'm hungry. And then I was like, wait, no. And then I immediately wasn't hungry anymore.
Also, also Lord Rizwell being the kind of dark side of Ned, where he's all about honor and duty, but he does it in such a terrible way where he buries people alive as their punishment for deserting Night's Watch, like
including
his own son, which he still loves, but it's so awful still. Like, you could have just killed them. You didn't have to bury them alive.
Oh, is that the 79 guards or whatever?
Yeah,
sentinels.
I do wonder if they're like actually frozen in there, and like if they'll ever come back up again, or if it's just a story.
It's all part of these stories that make this chapter just creepy and kind of scary, and Bran is afraid, and you're like, I know these are old stories, but you almost expect something to happen with them.
And how much of them are exaggerated after the fact or whatever? Are we talk about like the wildlings of the stories about, you know, the what's his name's children lost in the tunnels under the wall?
Isn't there some kind of theory about like old Nan being like right about everything, or am I making that up?
Oh, I definitely was thinking old Nan is right about everything. It's the only constant in all these books. Old Nan is right.
Yeah, you know, Daria was everyone for a while, and now I think like old Nan being like the shit about everything. I'm onto that train. I'm like down with that now.
I think it makes more sense than some other theories, honestly.
But the point I wanted to bring up is, like, it's kind of interesting how, like, the story about the Night's King, because this chapter just seems, like, about Bran not really knowing what to do and all these stories that he's learned from the past. And at the end of that section about the Night's King, it's like, Bran's like, maybe it was a Bolton or whoever else, but then it was a Stark. And the brothers had to fight each other. And I wonder if that's potential foreshadowing because Bran's beyond the wall now, and we don't really know if he's on the good side or the bad side, or what's really going to happen to him.
Bran and John.
Mm-hmm. Brothers.
We don't even know if John is going to be on the good side or the bad side.
Yeah, true.
Right now, John's still dead. Yeah.
So I like this little exchange with Sam and the kids and Hodor in this chapter. It's just good Martin kind of humor when he goes, he saved us from the dead men, him and his ravens, and he brought us here on his elk. His elk, said Bran, wonderstruck. His elk, said Mira, startled. His ravens, said Jojen. Hodor, said Hodor.
I absolutely love this passage.
Yeah.
I think it's my favorite piece of dialogue ever.
It's definitely my favorite Hodor, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, this chapter is pretty dark with the stories, but George kind of makes up for it in like slight humor, where like I think Mira's like, should we stay here or should we stay or should we leave or something like that, and Bran was just like, yes.
Yeah, no, he's like, are you afraid of the kitchens or the castle, and he's like, yes.
Oh yeah.
And I like the little parallel to John and Ygritte when Gilly looks around the kitchen and says, oh my god, this castle is so big. And Bran thinks, but that's only the kitchens. Like, if she saw Winterfell, she would be so amazed. And that's exactly the same thing John thinks when Ygritte freaks out about the tower.
Will Gilly make it to Winterfell then? Probably not.
Well, she's not going in the right direction.
No, not really.
She's seeing much cooler stuff.
Yeah. So.
Like, she's going to be the lady of Winterfell someday.
Aww. Her and Sam.
I love Gilly.
Yeah. Well, on a not as light note, we do get the scene where Bran slips skins, as they say, into Hodor. And
talk about that. Yeah. That's the first time he actually does it on purpose, like knowing what he's trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Hodor, like you can tell that he is definitely not okay with what's going on with that.
Yeah.
And I know that a lot of this book, like, I think is it the prologue where we get the scene where I forget everybody's name, but the guy works into that woman and she kills herself?
That's in Dance.
Yeah, that's the prologue of Dance.
Oh, shit. I skipped the book.
But they're the same book.
It's just Beast.
Can we talk about the gate?
Yes.
The gate is creepy as fuck.
Why is it there?
Like, there are some things where you kind of question if there's a supernatural effect to it, but this is definitely magic. Like,
yeah.
Right.
It looks like a living being.
It feels a little like on that Song of Ice and Fire to me, like just this weird gate with a face that talks. Like, it just, it's not, yeah, it's not what I think when I think of this series, but I don't have a problem with it or anything, but it definitely is a little jarring.
It's very magical.
Yeah. And too explicitly magical for a Song of Ice and Fire.
Yeah. It must be very bored out there with no one coming through ever. I don't know if this gate has feelings, but...
But honestly, like, who built this? Like, it's down at the bottom of a well?
I mean, like, it's in the wall, technically, right?
Yeah, it's, like, underneath the wall.
It is strange, like, how, like, this is completely, like, deserted as far as, like, the Night's Watch go. Oh, like, other than, like, there just isn't enough people. But... Like, it's weird that they don't know about this. And I wonder why that is, I guess.
Why wasn't it recorded? If it was really intended to be used by Night's Watchmen, why wasn't that information recorded? Was it sort of this secret side thing that some people were using?
Also, didn't everyone else assume that all these abandoned castles, like, access to beyond the wall were all, like, stoned and, like, filled in and, like, you couldn't get, like...
Yeah. But...
Is this guy a good enough sentinel that he can keep out everyone that's not a black brother?
I guess, because it's magic, so he can sense if someone's a black brother or not.
Yeah, but, I mean, Sam just let in, like, a whole bunch of people. Like, wonder if, like, a black brother was held hostage by the others. He'd be like, yeah, let them all in, it's cool. They're with me.
I don't know. I guess the Watch doesn't really remember, like, they... don't really remember it, and they don't really believe in it anymore because, well, as we saw with the Whites and the others, they kind of chalked it up to old legends, and there's not really anything to be worried about. It's just wildlings out there, and it turns out that this magic is still in the world, and I wouldn't be surprised if there was a document that said, like, there is a gate that you can open with a password if you are a brother of the Watch, and everyone's just like, nah, that's just bullshit.
Yeah, wouldn't Mance Rayder just be like, perfect, like, that's how we got in?
But Mance gave up his vows, like...
The gate doesn't know that.
The gate is magic! It can sense anything!
It knows everything!
Mance comes in, dressed in his cloak, like, he's getting it.
I mean, we could always also argue that, like, Sam's, like, betrayed his vows in some way because of Gilly, but, like, I know there's, like, a technicality that says, like, no, but, like, the gate is definitely, like, magical in some way to know that, like, Sam is cool. I don't know.
You're cool.
Sam is pure of heart.
You can
get it.
Yeah, bring your wildling child in through the wall. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Come on.
But the gate has to know who Mance Rayder is. Like,
how?
He can't trick it.
It's underneath the wall.
But he's the king beyond the wall. The gate can sense that.
The gate gets its newspaper every day. It knows what's happening.
I mean, is there, like, some kind of, like, werewood network that would, like, you know, like, the werewoods are kind of, like, all-knowing, kind of?
Exactly.
But there is a weirwood network, but all the weirwoods are just trees. This thing is a talking ant of a thing, like, that's stuck underground.
Maybe the other ones can talk too, but they haven't gotten, like, the password yet.
Why?
The password is actually password? God damn it.
But I do wonder, like, you know, I'm confused on why, like, Bran and Jojen and especially Mira are, like, totally fine with going through this thing to a guy that can't get through, but they can go through. So it seems so weird that everybody's so trusting of Cold Hands.
Yeah, it's like, here's this undead monster that brought us to the wall. I'm sure he'll be able to take you somewhere.
But he doesn't have blue eyes, so it's all right.
Guys, he has an elk. Come on.
He's riding an elk, which gives him street cred.
Exactly.
And ravens? Oh my god.
Because even Bran says, doesn't he say, like, the children in the forest rode elks?
No, it's the green men.
Matt, what's the difference?
They have antlers.
I had the one last maybe idea about this chapter. I'm not saying it means anything. I'm not saying Bran is the prince that was promised or anything, but there's a lot of mentions of him being a prince, of being the one being destined to go beyond the wall and everything. And at the very end, we have this image of a salty tear that comes from the gate as he goes through. And like, I'm not saying, yeah, I confirmed Bran is the prince that was promised. I'm just saying that it's always the same, the same imagery again that's being used in all of these books. And we have so many characters that who could be interpreted as being the prince that was promised and the born in tears and salt and stuff like that.
Why would the door cry though?
I don't know. It's magic.
Sad.
You know the future.
Does it know like?
Knows it's gonna be alone for like.
It was listening to a Prince song.
It's interesting to note though, like, you know, I feel like we keep on adding people to the possibility list of who's Azor Ahai, who's the prince that was promised.
And maybe no one is, like, everyone is, I don't know, but it's...
Everyone is.
Everybody's the prince.
Has Old Man made a prediction about who the prince that was promised is? Because if she hasn't said anything, I...
Don't trust it. Bran may not be Azor Ahai, but he is definitely Neo. He's the one.
Yeah. Also, I like that what made up Bran's mind is that Summer trusts Sam and licks his hand.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, okay, if Summer is cool, then we'll go.
Well, that's a sensitive way of making the choice.
Yeah.
If only Rob was so smart.
Yeah, definitely. I think Bran is a lot smarter when it comes to understanding that the importance of the wolves.
Yeah. I was just about to say, like, Bran has better instincts, but with Hodor, I am now, like, taking back my statement.
Yeah.
I love this thing that George will do to make his young characters sound young. Arya and Bran will both do this when they're like, hey, you gods, why don't you just do something already, you gods?
You old gods,
do something.
All right, thank you all for listening, and for those who read along at home, the next episode will cover the events from Tyrion 9, Jaime 7, and Arya 12, and I think will be hosted by Bina. You can find us and follow us on YouTube, iTunes, WordPress, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, as usual. Please subscribe and comment and let us know what you think. Also, if you want to get involved, go to a Podcast of Ice and Fire forums where you can find us chatting about all sorts of things and planning these podcasts. So don't hesitate to get in touch. Thank you to all my co-hosts for today's podcast.
Yeah, thanks for hosting. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Don't have huge rats in where you live?
I hope not. No rats is an acceptable size rat.
In one of my old apartments, you can always hear them fighting from the back deck.
Ooh.
Yeah, Boston's like the second rattiest city behind like Philly, I think.
Boston.
Zach, have you seen any?
I've heard tale though.
That doesn't make any sense. You just said Resnick four times. And who's Skaza?
That's a shame thing.
Okay.
I'm pretty confused. Sure it's not Skaza.
These fucking names. Like, seriously. Come on, man.
So many new characters.
What was the guy that Belwas fought, like Ozak Mopal or something? What the fuck is that?
Yeah, he's dead.
Well, at least he had a name different than its surname.
Resnick, well, Resnick.
That's exactly. Actually easier to remember.
Yeah, but it also doesn't make sense.
Why well, would he could be Resnick
if it's the same.
It could mean Resnick, son of Resnick. Which is possible, yeah. Like, we had...
I think that is what it means.
He just got an extra Resnack on him.
It's actually a sign. It's actually a sign of something. Like, the more Resnacks you acquire, the more power you have. He's trying to ascend to Resnack, more Resnack, more Resnack. That's his name.
That doesn't make any sense. You just said Resnack four times. So, kind of a side story to that. I was dating this girl once and it was like 3 weeks, 4 weeks in. And she's like, what's your last name? I was like, it's Varley. She's like, your name's Varley Varley? 3 weeks. 3 or 4 weeks of dating. Wow. And she thought my first name was Varley.
Good. Yeah. Promising.
Varley more Varley. Varley more Varley.
Change your forum name now.
Can we do the reintroductions so I could go Varley Mo Varley? Yeah. Also known as Varley. That doesn't make any sense. You just said Resnick four times.
Scary seeing his brother with Grey Wind's head on it, most likely.
Yeah. Must be traumatizing.
My son calls him when he wakes up and he comes into bed, you know, we're like, what's up? I had a serious dream. Serious dreams. So what was it? And then he'll describe, you know, his nightmare or whatever it was. It's usually not anything too bad, but it's the cutest thing. He calls them serious dreams.
It's very cute.
It's so funny how, like, dreams, like, there's sometimes, like, I'll be, like, really, like, I'll have a nightmare and then I'll wake up and I'll be like, I was dreaming about tomatoes. Like, why was that so scary?
Like, well, obviously you want pizza.
Yeah. Couldn't have it. That's why I was so scared.
Yeah, I fear what pizza will do to my diet, so it's coming in my dreams in the form of a tomato, a giant tomato trying to eat me. Ah. Oh, wait, wasn't there like a cartoon in the 90s that was like evil tomatoes or something?
VeggieTales?
There's a movie about killer tomatoes.
Yeah, was it a movie or I didn't really watch it. I thought it was a cartoon or something. Oh, yep, and there it is. Google.
Attack what is
the
it?
Killer tomatoes.
No way.
This is like a 1970s thing though. I could have sworn that like they had okay. Redone.
Oh, maybe they did a reboot.
Like a cartoon
in the 90s
thing. Or maybe, you know, we had like in the 90s we had like Street Sharks and Biker Mice from Mars and just. I don't even know what they were thinking with children's cartoons in the 90s. It's like some of them were great, but then you also had stuff that's like, why is this in front of children? This is so weird.
I mean, we also had like Roadrunner was probably my favorite like cartoon growing up. Like I would just watch like, you know, Bugs Bunny and all that on like every Saturday or Sunday morning and just like a bunch of people killing each other. Even in cartoon form.
I remember, what did I watch? It was like a short-lived, they had like a King Arthur cartoon when I was a kid, but it was like a football team went back in time and, you know, like an American football team went back in time and like became the Knights of the Round Table because the real knights were like frozen or something. And so it was like King Arthur and all these people with football references. It was very weird, but the opening theme song was extremely metal. Like it was like, oh dang, like this is hardcore. The show was not so hardcore. But it is this weird disconnect, I think, with parents, at least in my generation. I don't know if it's still like that, but like if you saw a cartoon, you were like, okay, I can just leave the room. My kid can watch whatever the hell this is because it's animated, yeah. Right?
That's exactly what my parents thought, I think.
Yeah. And then like you might look at it and go, wait, what the hell is going on in this? But like you're not going to, because you're an adult, you're like, I ain't paying attention, right? And but then like as soon as it was something live action, you're like, oh, there might be something objectionable in here, you know?
Yeah.
Which is weird because there are like adult cartoons and like
And they're super popular now.
A lot of adult humor. And, I mean, we have anime and we have mainstream, you know, you have Simpsons or
I Futurama wouldn't let kids watch sure. Rick and Morty.
No.
No.
Not, no. I mean, like, not that my son hasn't occasionally seen parts of it and thinks it's hilarious, but yeah.
I guess parts of it are okay.
I remember somebody in high school telling me, like, they used to be able to watch South Park, and then, like, around, like, age 8, his parents were like, South Park ended, it's not on TV anymore.
they finally were aware of what it was. They're like, there was, like, one of, like, the cursing episodes or something, and they were like, yeah. Wait, what is this we've been letting him watch? Chocolate salty balls? This is not right. Not right at all.
When I was really little, like, 3 years old, my parents only let me watch PBS because they thought other cartoons were for bigger kids and I was too small. And then, like, one of my mom's friends showed her Rugrats and she was like, oh, we can watch that. That's okay. And so I have a lot of Rugrats tapes from that era.
That's funny, though, because there's a lot of people I knew growing up who weren't allowed to watch Rugrats because, like, of Angelica being so mean or something like that.
Oh my God.
I know.
But people are mean in real life. Like,
I know.
We watched stuff, and then we watched, like, they had, like, I like Nickelodeon because we were able to watch, like, they had, like, the Hidden Temple and, like, I don't know, Double Dare, whatever all, like the shows where people competed were, like, Guts and stuff. Kids doing competitions was cool, but then like I don't know, my parents went through a phase eventually, like I would watch like X-Men and all these Saturday morning cartoons, and then my dad was like super religious and then was like, these things are all evil, so of course I knew how to use the VCR and he didn't, so I would just record the whole channel for like hours, and then when they go do errands I just watch it while they were gone.
Oh my god.
My funny story X-Men. With
you're so creative.
My funny story that my family loves to tell about watching Rugrats for me was that I watched it before I could read. So every time like the show would come on and they show like the episode title, I would make someone come in and tell me what the title of the episode was.
Say, like, my son's at that age. You know, he's in kindergarten learning to read, and it's so cute. Like sometimes he gets frustrated with it, but like he'll see me typing or something and he'll be like, "And," or like, you know, like he'll point out words that he knows. I know what you're saying. I'm like, that's so cute. Like he's having my fun parents, reading.
My parents like to tell people that like I was reading before like I knew how to read, because I would just like recite what my parents read to me at night, like from books. So I would like pick up the book that they were reading and just like recite it from memory. So they'd be she can
he's
read.
He's done that for a while.
That doesn't make any sense. You just said Resnick 4 times.
Yeah, it was. I like remember with high school specifically, because in college like you could really just take like specific courses, like unless you had to take like intro, but in high school I really disliked a lot of my history courses because like they it was like basically it seemed like constantly just repeating what I'd learned in middle school, whereas like I would take like English courses and then it would actually turn into like somewhat of a history course because we like read a lot of like specific time pieces, like even books like Great Gatsby were just like more interesting about the 1920s because they're very glazed over in like history classes, because we just want to get to the Great Depression and World War II.
Time to talk about the Battle of the Bulge and the Blitz and Rommel. And I mean, I'm sorry, like when I was a kid, like History Channel was pretty much all like World War II history videos.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, I spent a lot of time dissecting all those battles and stuff. I really love it.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I don't think they spend as much time on that stuff. I could be wrong, but I'll see in a few years when my kid gets there.
I'm trying to, like, remember what, like, it seemed like in my American history class that we went over a lot of stuff, like, from, like, you know, the beginning of American history, which is considered, you know, when Christopher Columbus came over. Which isn't really the story, but you know, that's where it started in
that's when America began.
That's where it started in the history classes. And
the guy who's American is named after that showed up earlier, he's like a footnote.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, and like they talk about all the travelers and stuff from Europe, and then like they go over a lot of those wars that were, like, you know, specifically the Revolutionary, but, like, also the ones, like, in between that and the Civil, and then get into, and then right when we get to, like, World War II, they're kind of like, oh, crap, we're out of time. Let's go really quickly through the rest of the history that,
yeah,
you, it's so recent that you
keep moving. Yeah,
well, there are some people, there are historians that believe, I think, what, anything in the last 50 years is not, history. Like, true history anyway, or, I don't know, but, like, I know when, like, if you're in Canada, I'm pretty sure, like, they start going through history and they just, like, cover the War of 1812 for 3 years because, like, that's all they have.
Yeah. Well, I had, like, the – my favorite teacher in middle school, who was so old school. He would have – like, he actually had us, like, recite, like, parts of the Constitution and shit from memory. Like, and that was, like, unheard of by the time I was in school. But anyways, like – and
really? They don't do that anymore?
It was really only him that,
like,
I ever
the preamble had. And all. I thought that was, like, standard in elementary
Adam,
school.
Adam, you're old.
I am not that old.
People in the United States of America, in order to form a more perfect union, do. I did.
Fight for the common defense.
So, yeah, we did, like, a whole thing where we'd break down, like, all those different pieces and, like, what they actually mean and whatnot.
Yeah, but, like, it, in tandem with that, he would also have, like, current event things where, like, he would have like everybody bring in 5 current events and have us, like, really read into them, and then, like, we'd have, like, our Fridays be just, like, reading those and describing, like, what's going on in the world. And I never had a class after that would do that as far as history goes, and even, like, you know, what they call, like, quote-unquote social studies. And I think I took a class in high school that was supposed to be, like, more current, like, just about, like, how the government works, and we really didn't go over any, like, current things, and if we did, it was kind of controversial. So
did they do the pledge when you were in school still?
Yeah, everybody still does.
Yeah, me too.
I think they still do, but some places they don't right now. So
wait, Alex, so, like, just, like, you know, it's really, like, important for, like, American schools to teach this American shit, but, like, how far does that go, like, as far as, like, French history for French students?
Oh, we do only French history, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot more history, so.
I'm not the best person to talk about it because I was in a French school in the U.S. for most of my school years, so we did have U.S. history, but in France, it's mostly just French history.
Yeah.
But I'm sure they cover, really, like, World War II and, like, things like that.
Yeah, you do cover, yeah, like, what was happening in other parts of the world.
Right, that makes sense. Because, like, with us, each individual states, like, you get, like, Tennessee history or Texas history or California history, et cetera.
Oh, yeah, I got some good.
And, like, some of those are more fun than others. Some of them you're like, can we not, like, Rhode Island
Sorry,
history,
Casey.
Like, is a 90-minute class, right? But, yeah, but, like, Texas history, I remember, was, like, super fascinating. You know, you get the Alamo and all that cool
Texas
stuff. California
is nuts.
History.
Yeah,
California
Texas
history was great.
New Jersey history is just,
like, you got to go
pan
for gold in Sacramento.
You just, like, learn about how there was an East and West Jersey, and that Perth Amboy was the fucking capital at one point.
There was an
and
East
that Trenton
and
was going
to
be what?
There was an
Sorry.
East and West Jersey, like a
yeah.
state, like the state was split at one point.
Yeah, because they couldn't decide on. I think it was something between, like, federalism and something else. I don't remember exactly, but there was an East and West Jersey, and Trenton was the capital of one, and Perth Amboy was the capital of the other.
When was this? This was after,
I don't
after, like,
remember
education,
if or? It was, I don't remember if it was before or after the Revolutionary War, but it was very early, like, history, of America. Yeah, it's very, like, yeah, you really just learn about, like, your state's history, and you, like, kind of, like, gloss over a lot of other states' history, because, I mean, like, the whole thing about America is, like, we're very proud, so, like...
Oh, that's clearly, I mean, in France, we still, like, learn about how great the Revolution was, and how amazing Napoleon is, I mean,
And how it's such a shame that colonialism ended and we don't have all these countries in Africa anymore.
I mean,
our colony really took a hit when we gave things back to the natives.
it's really, yeah, we don't have that much perspective on
yeah.
some of our history, and it's kind of a shame.
It's funny, like, I remember having this class in third grade, and, like, you know, I'm like, I think I was like 9, and they like taught us about how like in Prohibition times, our town was like a lot of people came to it to like fill up like with beer because we were still doing it. And like, that's like our, that's like literally our whole town's history. And I live on the fucking mountain. It happened. It's called Jugtown Mountain.
Jugtown Mountain.
Yes. Yes. Nice. We were the town of jugs. Not in a weird way, in a literally jug way.
Jug way.
Oh my gosh.
That doesn't make any sense. You just said Resnick 4 times.
It's like people get all mad. They're like, well, someday robots will do all the work and all the jobs. I'm like, well, then I guess they'll just have to give us all free money if we have no jobs. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know how the world, I don't think that's going to happen unless the robots like take over and enslave mankind, which is
that will happen. Ability.
That's yeah. There's like legit councils on artificial intelligence now that are like, that's probably going to happen. How do we avoid that? How do we make sure that doesn't happen?
Elon Musk that was like, guys, we need to like do something about this right now.
And yeah, he had this very serious speech,
and then a bunch of people freaked out at the White House.
Oh yeah, because all we're doing, it's like, I think he equated it to like the Manhattan Project in a way. It's like all we're doing is like trying to figure out how to make something. But like we're making something that potentially could like make itself and like become its own thing very quickly if we do it well enough. So like how do we ensure that while we're on this journey of discovery, creating artificial intelligence, like we don't create something that we quickly can't control?
I'm not gonna be able to relate this right, but the example I've heard that I think Elon Musk kind of explains is that even if you are creating or messing with AI in a way that, you know, you have benign intentions or like kind of innocuous intentions, like you want to make an AI that can like help you like get more paper or something like that. But then the AI, like going down the self-learning path of that, decides that it's going to oxidize the entire planet to, you know, like turn everything into the whatever base like resource that it wants. Like you can start with like these very basic and simple functions and it can get out of control if it has the like self-learning capacity.
That's reassuring.
It's like the example in Terminator is like when you already have like the factory that can build like the robot bodies or whatever, you know, like if you have like robot workers for a task and then like you make an artificial intelligence and somehow can like get access to that, you know, like
if you plug it into the internet and it decides its own way to it reads everything and decides its own way to be most efficient, and that
the best way to do my job is to kill all humans.
Exactly.
Why do you always decide that?
That could easily happen though, like that makes sense.
But then it also realizes it can't do it, so it's just gonna hide out in the internet for a while until like we develop the technology that allows it to kill us. Maybe it's already out there and we don't know it. It's in the cloud. It's a scary cloud monster.
Well, I'm definitely gonna have the best dreams tonight. I can tell you that.
The cloud is coming to kill you. You're like, I just dreamt about clouds. In the shape
and
of tomatoes.
Always tomatoes.
Tomatoes.
Yeah, why do we have a killer tomato cartoon? Like, what the hell? Kids don't need damn, like, eating.
I'm still traumatized from VeggieTales, let me tell you.
From VeggieTales? Why don't they have arms? The technology has gotten to the place where they could have legs and arms now for cheap, and they still don't add it.
Alex and Marie, do you guys know what VeggieTales are? Or?
Yes.
I know because it's already been mentioned on the podcast.
Okay.
I think you were there, Adam, and you were talking about this with Hannah, I think. And I was like, what is this?
That doesn't make any sense. You just said Resnick 4 times.
Yep, it's fun. I look forward to listening to the part I missed. Sorry about that, guys.
We just made fun of you the whole time, so.
I know. It'll get edited out though. So. leave in one reference, just one.
Bury the lead.
All right.